From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, prosecuting O.J. Simpson, we talk with Christopher Darden, who's written a new memoir called In Contempt. We'll talk about what he thinks went wrong with the prosecution's case and his reactions to being branded a traitor for prosecuting a celebrated African American. And we'll talk about Darden's life before and after the Simpson trial. He says his law career is over. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about one of the forgotten heroines of rhythm and blues, Camille Howard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A plane carrying Commerce Secretary Ron Brown from Bosnia to Croatia is missing. It was reported 3 hours overdue for its scheduled landing. A NATO spokesman says there has been a plane crash in the vicinity of Dubrovnik on Croatia's Adriatic coast. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says right now officials aren't sure whether that plane is Brown's plane.
We know that the plane was a U.S. Air Force T-43, which is their military equivalent of a 737, right? And then we do have, because of our military presence in the area, we are assisting with search and rescue efforts that are underway. I believe some other governments have indicated that they're participating in search and rescue. They've got both helicopters and C-130s involved in that. There is a report now that we can confirm that there is wreckage in the water, but we cannot confirm at this point that that wreckage is, in fact, Secretary Brown's plane.
McCurry says weather is bad in the region today. President Clinton canceled a speech at an anti-gang initiatives forum in Washington to await word about Brown, and he has spoken by phone with Brown's wife. Brown was visiting the region with the chief executive officers of a dozen U.S. firms. It's not clear whether some or all of those executives were on the plane. The purpose of the trip was to get American businesses involved in the massive task of rebuilding following the war in Bosnia. Brown had planned to spend 3 days in the region, meeting with local government and business leaders. Earlier today, he spent time with some of the U.S. peacekeeping troops near Tuzla. The FBI has opened a civil rights investigation into Monday's videotaped beatings of suspected illegal immigrants by Riverside County Sheriff's deputies in California. The beatings came after a long high-speed chase and were videotaped by a news helicopter crew. Hispanic activists chanted for justice as they marched outside the federal building in Los Angeles yesterday. The Mexican government has also condemned the beatings. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Mexico's foreign ministry expressed its indignation about the police beatings in a strongly worded diplomatic note sent to the U.S. State Department. While a Los Angeles TV crew documented the beating of two people, Mexican officials said it was three Mexican nationals who were brutally beaten by deputies of the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. Mexico condemned what it called this flagrant violation of human rights and demanded decisive action to eliminate discriminatory attitudes towards Mexicans in the U.S. Mexican officials expressed concern over how incidents such as this could generate tensions in ongoing talks between the U.S. and Mexico. Mexican news media gave extensive coverage to the Los Angeles beatings. Authorities here have repeatedly denounced alleged mistreatment of Mexican migrants in the U.S. I'm David Wellner in Mexico City.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 5 points at 5,666 in heavy trading of 170 million shares. This is NPR News. Texas parole officials are reconsidering a convicted child molester's longstanding request to be castrated. Larry Don McQuay's scheduled release to a halfway house in Houston was delayed yesterday because he said he was doomed to victimize more children. He claims to have molested 200 children so far. During his years in prison, McQuay has repeatedly said castration is the only way to control his urge to molest again. The European Union's agriculture ministers finally have agreed on a plan to help Britain solve its beef crisis and restore Europe-wide confidence in beef products. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
It took the agriculture ministers meeting in Luxembourg 40 hours of intensive negotiations before they reached agreement. The deal calls for the EU to pick up 70% of the cost of the slaughter of older British cows over the next 6 years. Around 4.7 million head of cattle are expected to be destroyed. The EU share of that cost is estimated to be around $2.4 billion. The ministers also agreed financial measures to help Europe's beleaguered cattle farmers. Despite the agreement, Britain is displeased with the deal because it does not call for the EU's worldwide ban on British beef to be lifted. British Agriculture Minister Douglas Hogg said the ban is not justified. Britain has until the end of the month to present its plans for slaughtering its older cows. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
A new study finds that teenagers are three times more responsive than adults to cigarette ads, especially flashy ones, such as the new 3D Joe Camel offer of free concert tickets. Researchers at the University of British Columbia in Canada concluded that it's quite easy to tempt the teen. Repeating our top story, a plane carrying Commerce Secretary Ron Brown from Bosnia to Croatia is missing. Reuters is now quoting a French Defense Ministry spokesman as saying that the plane carrying Brown has crashed near the city of Dubrovnik. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of the most important lawyers in the O.J. Simpson trial have new memoirs. Today we'll hear from prosecutor Christopher Darden, tomorrow from defense attorney Robert Shapiro. In Darden's new book, In Contempt, he says his law career is over. He can't go back into a courtroom expecting justice when there had been none in the strongest murder case he ever prosecuted. He also writes that he naively believed that his presence as an African American on the prosecution team would embolden his black brothers and sisters and show them that this was their system as well and they were making progress. Instead, Darden says he took a lot of heat and was branded an Uncle Tom, a traitor used by the man.
In our community, like everywhere, there is there are standards in terms of what is politically correct. And my being a prosecutor in the trial of the century was politically incorrect in many, in the views of many in the black community. And we had begun drawing a line in the sand months before the trial actually started. On the one side were those of us or those politically astute people in the black community who believed in O.J. Simpson's innocence, or if they didn't believe in his innocence, they believed that it would be a positive move for the black community to have Simpson acquitted. And I wasn't on that side of the line. I was on the other side.
Are there examples of how you felt that you were shut out by parts of the black community?
Well, I received a lot of mail calling me names and the like, obviously. It created a situation for me where we had to take extra precautions just, you know, for my coming and going and the like. You know, it's, and on my part, I began to feel an overwhelming sense of not being welcomed. I had an idea of what people were saying about me in the hair salons and the barbershops in South L.A., and I had friends who would tell me that people were very adamant and vehement in their dislike for me and in their view that I should not be part of the prosecution. I describe other things and encounters that I have in the book. Someone spit at me and things like that. Those are examples, I think.
I think your feelings were made even worse by the fact that O.J. Simpson, who you believed was a murderer and who was a wealthy celebrity and you describe as rarely socializing with blacks, was becoming a symbol of the oppression of African Americans.
True. And, you know, not only was justice turned on its head, but apparently how civil rights and the issue of civil rights were going to be perceived, I think, by some blacks. O.J. Simpson was not, he was not a community activist. He was not a politician. He was not someone having a long history of activism in the black community. And now he was being made into some sort of political prisoner and a symbol of black pride and a symbol injustice and oppression. And it made no sense to me. O.J. Simpson has been given every opportunity any American could ever want, despite his race. And just very, very strange.
Your critics during the trial felt that you were being used as, you know, the black face in prosecuting O.J. Simpson to give the prosecution a better, politically more correct look. But there were times when you felt that your appointment was a little manipulative as well.
Well, it's not that I felt that way so much as I certainly had that concern on some occasions, and I certainly had that concern when I joined the prosecution team initially.
How did you think that through when deciding what to do after you were asked to join the prosecution?
Well, I had been friends with Marsha Clark for many, many years, and we had worked on other cases together, cases not involving race, cases where race wasn't an issue. We worked in the same courtrooms together. We were contemporaries in the office. I had conducted the investigation in the Al Cowlings Bronco chase incident, so I knew a lot about the Simpson prosecution case. I had been a prosecutor for 14 years, a very successful one. I had tried 19 murder cases. So certainly I consider myself competent and capable.
And when did you, was it hard for you to decide that you were going to, that you wanted to do it?
Well, initially, I was brought on as the case manager, and being brought on as the case manager, I'd be in the background supervising law clerks, junior lawyers, helping direct the investigation, and acting as a liaison with the LAPD, and that was fine with me. When I was asked to take a more active role and actually appear on camera and sit at the counsel table and start putting on witnesses, well, that was a little different. And I had to think very carefully about that because I knew that anyone joining the prosecution team, anyone black, would be viewed very, very negatively back home. And so I gave it a lot of thought.
Christopher Darden is my guest, and he has a new book that's part autobiography and part a memoir about the trial, and it's called In Contempt. The latest news on the trial is about the juror who was dismissed after an anonymous letter was sent to Judge Ito by someone who said that they were a receptionist at a literary agency. And the letter said that this juror's husband had approached the agency saying that his wife planned to write a book on the trial and that his wife already knew that she was going to give a guilty vote on O.J. So the judge dismissed this juror. Now the L.A. District Attorney's Office is investigating this story. Do you think that there's jury tampering involved here?
Oh, well, I think it's a clear case of jury tampering. It's clear that someone had targeted that juror. It was obvious, I think, to most people watching the trial, certainly in the courtroom, that this juror was very bright. She knew what DNA was. She knew how important it was, and she knew how reliable forensic DNA science was as well. The defense, it was clear that the defense didn't like her. Whenever an opportunity came up to challenge her or to question her conduct, they were right there to question it and to argue for her removal.
Did the prosecution ever consider investigating this anonymous letter?
Well,
during the trial?
No, and I'll tell you why. Judge Ito assumed responsibility for all juror investigations early on in the trial. And I write about that in some detail. We were forbidden, precluded by the judge from investigating any issues relative to any jurors. It was Judge Ito's responsibility to investigate that letter, not ours.
So your suspicion is what? That somebody who wanted O.J. to get off, wanted to get rid of this juror who they felt would give a guilty vote?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only did they succeed in getting her off, but there was another juror, another woman, who was a non-black a woman, the woman who wrote Florio Button a note giving her the heads up on the fact that Ito was looking into the issue of whether or not someone was writing a book. That juror was also dismissed. And so the letter writer was twice as successful as he or she had hoped to be. And it was so successful that it caused the ratio, as I recall, I'm not sure, but I think it caused the number of black jurors on the panel to increase by one.
If the jury tampering was proven to be true, What would happen? What would the meaning be?
Well, obviously, we couldn't retry O.J. Simpson. Double jeopardy has attached. We couldn't do that. We would, if we could identify the source of the letter, we would bring that person to justice. Mm-hmm. I think it might affect his civil trial. If the public believes that the defense played dirty tricks to spring him on that criminal case, I think there'll be a backlash, and I think we'll see that backlash in a humongous jury verdict in favor of the Goldmans and the Browns.
Christopher Darden, when you joined the prosecution, the jury was already picked, and you say you had a bad feeling about the jury right away.
Sure. If you've ever walked into a room and gotten the feeling that people were looking at you and didn't like you, that's the impression I got from these jurors the first time I walked into court and saw them.
It was just a feeling?
Well, just a feeling. I sensed some hostility on their part. And it was clear to me that they didn't like me, and I don't think they liked Marsha Clark at the time either.
And you think that the jurors were intentionally chosen so that they'd have no more than a high school education?
Well, I think that both sides have in mind ideal jurors. And I'm sure that the defense mindset was that they wanted people who would not take the time to try and learn about DNA or who would not consider it reliable. And people tend not to consider reliable or significant things that they don't understand, and I think. And so I think that if you look at the educational backgrounds of the jurors, I think that you will see that there is a certain pattern to them.
So you think the defense wanted jurors who weren't very educated?
I would imagine that was their position. I don't know that they'll tell you that or the rest of us that, but I would bet that was the case.
My guest is Christopher Darden, a key prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case. He's written a new memoir called In Contempt. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Darden is my guest, and his new book is called In Contempt. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me the prosecution tried to make the case that O.J. Simpson was a wife abuser who had threatened to kill his wife before and finally delivered on that promise, whereas the defense was playing the case according to forensics. They were arguing forensics. And they won, and the prosecution lost. What went wrong with the domestic abuse strategy?
Well, let me just say this. We also played the forensic game, and I think the forensic evidence all points to O.J. Simpson. But what went wrong? I think a number of things went wrong. I think, first of all, we picked the wrong jury, and we picked the wrong jury at the wrong time. I think that... of course, we as prosecutors, we receive cases after the murders and after the crime scene investigations occur. And so we have no say in which a criminalist is going to collect evidence. So we had no say in the assignment of Dennis Fung and Andrea Mazzola as the on-scene criminalist, for instance. I think that the crime scene investigation was competent and not perfect. I think that the defense lawyers on the other side were very good lawyers, and they exploited some things. I think they were allowed to literally get away with murder in terms of the manner in which they questioned witnesses, in terms of the innuendo, the outrageous hypotheticals that Ito allowed them to place into the record. You know, there were some times when you couldn't tell what the witness was testifying to, whether it was fact or hypotheticals. I think a variety of things went wrong. I think the racist... The epithets and the focus and the way the trial was allowed to focus on issues of race and not issues of guilt or innocence. I think there are many things that went wrong in this case.
Was there evidence you would have liked to admit, but you couldn't, about O.J. and Nicole's relationship and the history of domestic abuse in that relationship?
Well, absolutely. First of all, I would have liked to have admitted her diaries. She had written some notes during the few days prior to her her death, as a matter of fact. And in one note, I think the date of the note was June 6th, I guess she had, Simpson had been calling her repeatedly, and she had hung up on him. And she writes in her notes, she quotes, actually, the things that he said to her, and they were very, very vicious and full of profanity. And they were threatening, I think. And I would have liked to have introduced into evidence her call to a domestic violence shelter 4 days before her actual death, because she is calling that shelter because she is distraught and she is in fear of her life, and things are going on in her life that she can't handle. She believes that she is about to be killed, and she tells that shelter who she expects the murderer to be, and she talks about being stalked even then. And she talks about being threatened verbally, and she identifies the person who was threatening her. When I hear people walk around and say, "Well, O.J. Simpson didn't do this," I think that they should, if they can, they should take a look at the call Nicole Brown made to the Sojourn Domestic Violence Shelter.
Why couldn't you admit the diaries that you mentioned and then this phone call?
Well, Judge Ito ruled that these were hearsay, that it was hearsay, and it was precluded under the hearsay rule.
Now, you couldn't admit evidence from the slow speed chase, the fact that O.J. Simpson was traveling with a fake beard and mustache, had almost $9,000 in cash. Why didn't you?
Well, I conducted the grand jury investigation into the Bronco chase, and also into Simpson's conduct and demeanor and actions prior to him fleeing Robert Kardashian's house the morning of June 17. So I called all of the people in the house to the witness stand to testify in front of the grand jury. And the picture that they paint is one of an O.J. Simpson who was suicidal, distraught, crying for hours. He is telephoning friends and family members, telling them goodbye, basically, asking people to take care of his children because he won't be around anymore to take care of them. There was a psychiatrist in the house. He has been get prescribed medication to help him deal with his problems, and apparently he had not taken his medication that day. And many of those witnesses who paint him as someone who was suicidal were very, very emotional, understand. Many witnesses wept, as a matter of fact, during their testimony. We could have introduced evidence of the Bronco chase, but to do so would have placed O.J. Simpson's state of mind on June 17, as it was June 17, in issue. And that means that we'd be hearing and seeing all of those weeping witnesses on the stand describing O.J. Simpson as suicidal.
Well, what I don't understand is, couldn't you have made the argument that if he was suicidal, it's because he knew what a horrible act he just committed and couldn't live with himself?
Well, I think that I think that outside of a court of law, you could certainly make that argument. Whether or not we'd be allowed to make that argument in Judge Ito's court is an entirely different issue. It's an entirely different issue because it is speculation, I think. But, in addition, the trial had to end at some point. We certainly considered putting the Bronco chase in. And then there were other problems. Okay. For instance, it was A.C. Cowlings that had the $8,700 on his person and not O.J. Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
When Cowlings was arrested that night at Rockingham, the LAPD didn't book the $8,700 into evidence. They booked it into Cowlings' personal property and returned it to him when he was let out on bail. So in other words, it was the LAPD's position, and I assume it would have to be their official position, that the $8,700 was in evidence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Darden, and he has a new book called In Contempt. Having O.J. Simpson try on the gloves was your idea. What did you expect to happen?
I expected that he would probably do whatever he could to ham it up.
Mm-hmm.
I expected that the gloves would go on, and I expected that the gloves would fit, would go on his hand. And I think that both of those two things are exactly what happened.
You think, but the gloves didn't fit when?
No, the gloves fit.
You still think the gloves fit?
I think if you just look at the photographs, I think you see two gloves on each of his hands.
So how come so many people think they didn't fit?
I don't think they've looked at the photographs carefully enough. I mean, you have the latex gloves going down his wrist, which I think certainly gives an illusion or adds to the illusion that they don't fit. But they don't fit perfectly, but they fit well enough to hold a knife and well enough to kill two people. And I think that when you look at the photograph of him with his palms up, I think you see two gloves on his hand. And when you look at the photograph of him holding the marker high above his head, with his fists clenched, they fit.
Well, are you saying that the gloves shrank from the time he originally wore them, or that he was walking around with gloves that were a really, really snug fit?
I think the gloves had a snug fit originally. I think the gloves did shrink some. I think the latex contributed to the way they fit in the courtroom, but I think they fit. We established, I think, beyond any question that those gloves were bought for him by Nicole. We have pictures of him wearing those gloves. I don't think that the glove demonstration is all that big an issue, quite frankly.
But the jury probably disagrees with you.
Well, I think some of the jurors have already said publicly that they felt the gloves fit at the time.
What did what went through your mind at the end of the trial when Johnny Cochran said to the jury, if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit?
Well, I thought it was a very, very simple I think it was an insult to their intelligence, frankly. Or that's how I would have felt had I been on the jury, quite frankly. You know, the little sayings, the little rap things, the little rap rhymes, the little tunes, the little rap tunes would have been offensive to me. And that's all I thought about it.
You write in your book that you're haunted by mistakes, errors that might have contributed to losing the case. Is there what is it particularly that haunts you now?
Well, obviously the glove demonstration, and I think that any imperfection, any slip, every slip, I think, contributes or may have contributed to the eventual verdict. I think that I should have been a lot more confrontational with Lance Ito. I think that we should have, I don't think I ever should have let him up off the mat. And I think that each and every day that we spent together should have been unpleasant for him. I think he got away with way too much. I don't think that he managed the courtroom in the manner that a judge ought to. And we should have insisted on more from him. I mean, he allowed those defense lawyers to shake their heads and do all kinds of things, inappropriate things, for nine months, and although we take him to task on that in chambers off the record sometimes, he promised, to do something about it, or he'd tell the defense to stop doing it. He allowed those types of things to go on, and I think that I should have been in his face a little bit more.
Christopher Darden has written a new memoir called In Contempt. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear from Simpson defense attorney Robert Shapiro, who has also written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Christopher Darden and talk about Mark Furman, Johnny Cochran, cameras in the courtroom, and the family crisis Darden dealt with during the Simpson trial. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Boogie Woogie piano player Camille Howard, who we're listening to now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Christopher Darden about prosecuting O.J. Simpson. After the trial, Darden gave up practicing law and is now teaching. He was a 15-year veteran of the L.A. County Prosecutor's Office. Darden has written a new memoir called In Contempt. Let's talk about Mark Furman. As we said before, you'd spent 6 years prosecuting corrupt cops in Los Angeles, and suddenly Mark Furman was your guy. You know, Mark Furman was the guy you were supposed to present in your case, and you knew that there were previous allegations about him planting evidence and being corrupt, and you say you didn't like him from the first time you saw him. There was something eerie about the guy, you write. If you had it to do over again, what would you have done differently with Furman?
Well, I thought that we should probably be a little bit more confrontational with Mark Furman, actually. I mean, the jurors had heard that he was a racist. And I think that that was the mindset of most people. And so I thought it might be nice to confront him on the issue of race. And to really kind of beat him up a little bit, you know, almost cross-examine him on some issues, I think, to let the jurors know that, hey, this is who the guy is. You know about the allegations. We know about the allegations. This is his position. Because we're putting him on doesn't mean that, hey, he's one of us, though, that he's one of our best buddies or anything like that. You know, we're putting him on because he's a witness in this case and he has evidence.
You were assigned to handle Mark Furman, but you wanted to transfer him to somebody else because you thought, I think what you write is that it would be bad for you personally and bad for the case, for you as an African-American to be the person questioning him.
Well, yeah. If I were to present Mark Furman, and it was later determined that he had used epithets or that he was the racist people, some people said he was, or if additional evidence was uncovered, then I would be buying right into the so-called Uncle Tom sellout being used by the man argument. And I'm sure that was of some concern to the jurors. Should that happen? Should I put him on? And should that happen? I think it would have destroyed any credibility I might have had with the jury.
So that argument was strong enough for the other members of the prosecution team.
Well, they had no choice because I wasn't going to put him on.
Right.
I told Marsha Clark I won't put him on. I can't put him on. I won't do it, and I didn't do it, and she did.
You write that Judge Ito's worst decision was putting cameras in the courts. How do you think cameras in the courtroom affected your presentation?
Well, you know, for me, I tried to just be me. I mean, I was angry and brooding because I didn't want to be there and because I thought the entire trial was a farce. And I was tired. So I was just Chris Darden. That's how I felt. That's who I was. Hey, that's me. But others in the courtroom, I think, and I'm sure that there were days that I played to the cameras, but others in the courtroom played to the cameras all the time, including Ito. Certainly Cochran and Shapiro played to those cameras. And I think that's obvious by the length of the arguments, the legal arguments in the case, the venomous arguments, the personal attacks. And I got in my licks just like everybody else got in their licks. But I think we're all, in some sense, playing to the cameras. We had become instant celebrities, and we liked it.
Did you? Did you like it?
Well, I liked, that people knowing that, knowing my name, yeah, I think I liked that. I think I liked that. I didn't like people going through my trash and questioning my family and things like that and invading my personal life. I didn't like that at all. But, you know, that I had a famous name, I think that was great.
You write during the part where you had O.J. Simpson put on the gloves that Johnny Cochran asked for a wide shot, not a tight shot. How much power did the defense and the prosecution have in affecting what the camera angles were?
None, really. None. The only power I think the defense had was in insisting that the cameras not zoom in on what was on the on counsel table, because the cameras could zoom in tight enough to actually read the documents on the table, and that was it, I think.
You knew Johnny Cochran years before the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yes.
When you were in the Special Investigation Division of the prosecutor's office, and you were you were prosecuting cops, you sometimes worked with Cochran. I mean, not directly, but he was working with some of the same people. What was your relationship and what was his role in the cases you were working on?
Well, I for instance, would be investigating a controversial police shooting. And Cochran would be representing the shooting victim or the shooting victim's family, assuming the victim was deceased. And so being a prosecutor, I would conduct grand jury investigations. I would subpoena police records and the like, and I would assemble these massive files, and I would do an in-depth investigation of the shooting. Now, my objective, of course, is to see whether or not a crime has been committed. Cochran, on the other hand, representing the family, his objective is to see if he can't file a civil suit and make some money. And, you know, for him and for the victims, the victim families, certainly. And so, in a sense, we were on the same side of the issue.
But you're right that Cochran often instructed his clients and some of the witnesses not to cooperate with the DA's office, and that way they could later do a personal lawsuit and settle for a big money.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, you know, the less said early, the better. When you have time or an opportunity to spend time with your witnesses, certainly in civil cases and civil lawyers, I don't know if they'll agree with this or not, but, you know, if you spend enough time with a witness, you can help shape shape their testimony.
So how would you describe your feelings now about Johnny Cochran? Do you respect him as a lawyer?
Sure, I respect him as a lawyer. He's a very good lawyer.
And as a person?
Well, as a person, I don't know. I don't think it matters much, quite frankly, whether I respect him as a person. He is a good lawyer. He's an influential personality in Los Angeles, in Los Angeles politics and in the black community. And I think that respecting him as a lawyer and as an individual is enough.
Christopher Darden is my guest, and he has a new book called In Contempt. In your new book, In Contempt, you write not only about the O.J. Simpson trial, you write about yourself, your family, your childhood. You had, I believe, 7 brothers and sisters, and you say that there was usually not enough food to fill you up. You were always hungry when you were young, so you ended up stealing food.
Well, what I say really is I used to steal food all the time. And so I wondered, was I poor or was I... Or was I just a kid who was always hungry all the time? Certainly, my father was a welder, and my mother later on was a cafeteria worker. And they had 8 kids, and we were all born within 12 years or so. So she had a mess of kids, little kids all at once, and we were all just fighting for our space. And when you have 8 kids on a welder's salary, you don't just leave food lying around. But I think that the way I grew up with all my brothers and sisters, I think really helped to shape me, I hope, into a decent fellow as an adult.
When you were young, you write that you stole food and then also got into stealing clothing and would have these contests with other friends over who could steal more stuff. And you say it really wasn't until you became a lawyer or prosecutor that you started to feel real pangs of conscience and started to understand what it's like. What it must be like to have somebody, to have something stolen from you, what it's like to be a victim.
Sure.
And I thought it was interesting that it took becoming a prosecutor to develop that kind of empathy for the victim. Was it just like a teenage thing? I mean, you're hardly the first teenager who shoplifted.
I think it was just a teenage thing. I certainly haven't done that since I was a teenager. And, I think it comes from, leaving Richmond and going on to college and getting to college and still not having very many bucks and sort of being on my own. When I went to college, it was up to me to find a way to pay tuition and to live. And there wasn't a whole lot left. When you're 18 or 19 years old, you want to wear bell-bottom jeans. You want to wear the latest fashions. You want earth shoes, you know? I mean, I needed my earth shoes.
To put it bluntly. My guest is Christopher Darden. He's written a new memoir about prosecuting O.J. Simpson called In Contempt. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Christopher Darden.
Your brother was very sick during the O.J. Simpson trial. He was dying of AIDS. You write about your brother in your book and about how you always learned a lot from him. You learned how not to steal. I mean, because he stole the wrong way. He was the one who was always getting caught. And you learned from him a lot of what not to do and how not to do it. What was it like to grow up with a brother whose life was taking such a different direction from yours, dealing drugs, crime?
Well, you know, he was my big brother, and like a lot of kids, you know, I looked up to my big brother. When we were smaller kids, we did a lot of things together, and we were very close. And as he got older and became a teenager and began doing some of those other things, there was this distance that began to develop between us. As we lost that closeness, it was very, very apparent to me. And it was difficult for me to deal with and accept early on. He eventually became addicted to heroin and crack cocaine. And during the later years of his life, those were the things that they owned him, literally. They literally owned him. And that hurt. That hurt because we didn't know what to do. We didn't know how to help him. We didn't understand the magnitude of his addiction, and we didn't understand just how much he was actually suffering. I was a prosecutor, and I knew a little bit about drug addiction and the signs and the like, I was completely helpless. We were all helpless. We were helpless to just watch the drugs consume him.
Did you have a strategy for dealing with him, trying to help him and give him money, or refusing to give him money, knowing that it would probably go for drugs?
You know, it is a real dilemma, because a catch-22 situation. Because he would ask for money, and he'd be sleeping on the street, and he would say, "I need $70 to get a room for a couple of days, or $50 to get a room for a couple of days." And you fear that if you give him the $50, he's going to buy drugs with it. But then again, you fear him sleeping out on the street in the rain, and he won't come inside. You know, he won't come into the family home, and he won't go into a program. What do you do? He's your brother. He's your son. You give him the $50. That's what you do. You give him the $50, and you pray.
Did your brother start to see you as the law enforcement guy who he had to hide things from?
He certainly never came around me with the stuff. And I would like most people wouldn't. And I assume that he certainly kept those types of things out of my view.
Did you undergo any kind of crisis about how to divide your time between your brother and the trial while the trial was going on?
Well, yeah. You know, I would talk to him on the phone on occasion, and that helped. But the trial was all-consuming, and it was difficult to take time off. And the other thing is that, you know, him being sick it's a heavy burden to carry, even if you're there. I mean, my family was there, and my sisters were there, and brother were there, and in-laws were there, taking care of him. And for me to be in Los Angeles messing around with this farce, this circus of a trial, while they're shouldering the burden of doing all they can to make him comfortable and the like, you know, I feel bad about not being there.
Mm-hmm.
After the trial, probably between October and November, for instance, I probably flew to San Francisco 15 to 18 times.
To be with him?
Yeah. And, of course, a lot of that was too late. It was only in the first few weeks that he was even remotely the person I knew him to be. I remember walking into church one morning, and he didn't know I was coming. And I walked up behind him, and he turned to face me, and he was wearing these glasses, and they were, you know, they seemed like Coke bottle thick glasses, and I was talking to him, and he says, and after a minute, he says, "Chris, is that you?" And at that point, he had had a brain infection, and he was losing his sight, and there was dementia, and he was, you know, and he was on the decline. So there wasn't a whole lot of quality time after the verdict.
Are you still planning on giving up law?
Well, I'm teaching law at Southwestern University in Los Angeles, and so I'm a law professor. Nobody ever calls me professor, you know, and I'm getting sick of that. But I don't plan to go back into the courtroom.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. Why should I? I mean, it's been 15 years. I've been doing that for 15 years. And it dawned on me one day that there are just so many more important things in life, you know.
With injustice?
Well, not only with injustice. I mean, whether I'm in the courtroom or teaching law, I think that I'm still involved in the law, and I'm still involved in the fight for victims' rights. I don't think I necessarily have to try cases to do those things.
Now, let me ask you this. Your last encounter with being in the courtroom for the O.J. Simpson trial left you really cynical about being a lawyer. I mean, you were cynical about the jury, about the strategy of the defense team, angry at Judge Ito. So what message are you passing on to your law students about what their attitude should be toward the criminal justice system?
Well, you know, my law students have asked me the same question, and the first thing I remind them of is this, and that is I could not be here telling you this if I were still in the courtroom. Okay, and what I tell my law students is that they shouldn't let these kinds of things happen, that they shouldn't buy in to the defense approach to practicing law, that they should have some ethics and some morals, and that they should follow the rules. I think that a good lawyer could have accomplished a lot of what the defense accomplished in this case without resorting to trickery, without surrendering their ethics and morals. I'm teaching my kids to be good lawyers, effective lawyers, but the kind of lawyers who can go home and sleep every night and sleep well knowing that they've done all that they could within reason, within the law, and within the rules of ethics to protect their client's interests.
Is your attitude, too, I'm tired, now it's your turn?
My attitude is this, and that is that, you know, life, that, you know, we have different seasons in life, and my season is up. My time has come. It's my time has come and gone, and now it's your turn. It's your time.
And one last question. How has your experience with the O.J. Simpson trial affected your views on race and justice in America, and also on your future work as in activism, as an activist?
Well, I think that my participation in the trial certainly gives me an opportunity to speak and to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that when you have a voice, and if you think you have something important to say, I think you ought to say it. And I'll be saying some things about race and about law and about justice as long as I have this voice and as long as I have the opportunity.
Any regrets?
Well, I could have done without the experience, I'll tell you.
Could you have? I mean, you know, you're getting a lot of money now and certainly a lot of fame, and you could probably write your own ticket now.
Well, you know, I feel like I had written my own ticket the prior 14 or 15 years. I had a very good life. I think being a member of the LA County DA's office is the best job in the world. And I was looking to move on, quite frankly. But, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't feel like I was put on this earth to make a lot of money or to be rich. That's not why I'm here, and I know that. And I've always known that. I'm here to do some damage to the things I think that are wrong and to correct some wrongs. And that's how I see things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
Christopher Darden's new memoir is called In Contempt. He's now teaching law at Southwestern University School of Law in Los Angeles. Tomorrow we'll talk about defending O.J. Simpson with Robert Shapiro, who put together The Dream Team. Shapiro also has a new memoir. Coming up, Ed Ward profiles a forgotten heroine of rhythm and blues. This is Fresh Air. The early heroes of rhythm and blues are overwhelmingly male, especially the instrumentalists, yet one of the most dynamic was the woman who powered the popular band led by Roy Milton. Rock critic Ed Ward has this profile of Camille Howard.
Why did you break my heart? Why did you break my heart? If you didn't want me, baby, why did you have to start?
It was 1946, and in the number two position on the race charts was this song, R.M. Blues, the first record by Roy Milton and his Solid Senders. Just listening to it, you know that the piano player must be Milton himself. But no, Roy Milton was a singing drummer, and the piano that propelled his band was played by one of the forgotten heroines of rhythm and blues, Camille Howard. Camille Howard was born in 1914 in Galveston, Texas, and, like so many other Gulf-based black people, migrated to California during World War II with the lucrative and integrated shipbuilding trade. She was no Rosie the Riveter, though. She knew she was a great piano player in the classic East Texas style, and it didn't take much to convince Roy Milton that she'd be an asset to his band. Milton's was a small combo, six pieces, so every player counted. With his second single, Milton's Boogie, he initiated the boogie-woogie craze that was to dominate rhythm and blues in the immediate post-war era, and, of course, that was a piano-based sound. Camille Howard was as important to Milton's success as was his own ability to arrange his small band to sound bigger. They were as popular with white audiences as black ones in Los Angeles, second only to Louis Jordan's Timpani Five nationally, and their record sales established Specialty Records, the pioneering L.A. label. Thrill Me was the first Milton record to feature Camille singing, and it was a smash. She decided she wanted to make some records under her own name, but time was drawing short. The American Federation of Musicians was going on strike at the beginning of 1948, and no new records could be made until it was over. Specialty put Camille in the studio with a rhythm section, and she cut a few numbers. With only a couple of minutes left in the studio, she started banging out a boogie, and a hit was born. Extemporaneous Boogie sold 250,000 copies, due no doubt in part to the astonishing virtuosity of her playing, but also because the flip side showed another facet of her talents.
True, I'm just crazy over you. No one else will do. Darling, you don't love me. Had it all planned out someday, that things would come my way. But darling, you don't love me.
You Don't Love Me was a virtual copy of a currently popular song by Paul Gayton, but in those days, that was considered a plus. Partially because she was such an integral part of the Milton band, and partially because times were changing, Camille Howard never had quite as big a hit again.
Morning, God.
Money Blues hit the top 10 on the race charts, but the sales, thanks to extensive counterfeiting, were disappointing. The label kept faith in her, no doubt as much because they needed Milton as anything, and in 1949, they told her they were preparing an album, the label's first of her songs. It never came to pass, and Camille stayed with Roy Milton until he went into semi-retirement in the late 50s. After that, Camille Howard joined the church and became too devout to consider sitting down at the piano again. As anyone who listens to Roy Milton's astonishing string of hits can hear, she was one of the greats of early rhythm and blues.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. The second volume of Camille Howard's music has just been released on the Legends of Specialty series. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.